Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
And I'm Mark Chilla. Annie is away this week on today's show.
You know, markets are tough on farmers. You've got to pack everything up. You have to guess roughly or exactly how much produce to bring. Sometimes you're driving hundreds of miles to the market, so there's gas involved.
Steve Holt is a food writer. We talked to him about what the phrase farmer's market means and what it doesn't. What about the word organic? Harvest Public Media presents a variety of opinions. Much of our industrial food system is mechanized. We'll go inside a beef plant today that relies on workers to do hard work with their hands. We'll also juice some watermelon with Chef Daniel Orr, and we'll get a homebrewing 101 lesson with some beer geeks known as the Hop Jockeys. Excited to hear the dulcet tones of Luann Johnson in our newscast today.
It looks like there's three stories from the week, Mark. Agribusiness giant Monsanto has abandoned plans to take over competitor Syngenta, putting to rest speculation that the company was pushing a $46.5 billion hostile bid. The company announced in a press release that it would no longer pursue merger plans. The company blames Syngenta's rejection of their proposal, which fell short of the Swiss pesticide producer's financial expectations. According to anonymous sources cited by Forbes, Bloomberg, and other business media, to overcome an early rejection, the company had previously increased its takeover offer to $46.5 billion. Monsanto also offered a higher portion of cash and raised its insurance offer from $2 billion to $3 billion in case antitrust regulators blocked the deal. Following news of the scuttled deal, shares of Syngenta fell 18%, and Monsanto's shares climbed 8%. Germany has started the process of banning genetically modified crops within its borders. New rules give individual countries within the EU the ability to ban GMOs as long as it isn't based on health or environmental concerns. As Reuters reports, German Federal Minister of Food and Agriculture, Christian Schmidt, wrote to fellow state governments about the country's intention to participate in the ban. Scotland, on the other hand, has already declared a ban. Nearly 30 organizations, including scientific-based organizations and Edinburgh University, have submitted an open letter pleading with the government to rethink the ban. Those against the ban argue that outlawing GMOs will hinder research and threaten to make Scotland's scientific research non-competitive. Scottish Environmental Secretary Richard Lochhead argued the ban was supported by environmental groups, but agreed to meet with the detractors. EU countries have until October 3rd of this year to declare they want out of future genetically modified approvals. And a 24-acre food hub and green living wonderland in Kentucky has dropped plans to include a $40 million composting facility that drew fire from community activists. The West Louisville Food Port facility was originally slated to include a plant from Indiana-based Nature's Methane that would convert food waste into biofuel. Community members and some city officials were concerned the facility would eventually pollute nearby neighborhoods. The lot where Foodport will be built sits on an old factory site where residents suffered health problems from industrial waste for decades. Despite the break from Foodport plans, Nature's Methane has announced it still intends to build a facility in Louisville. Foodport expects to break ground on the remaining parts of the $25 million facility early next year.
These articles and many others are posted on our website. You can find so much at eartheats.org. Luann Johnson, thanks for being here today.
It's always fun. Thanks.
Slaughterhouses and meatpacking plants throughout the country employ a lot of people. About a quarter of a million workers in the U.S. stun, kill, and eviscerate the animals we eat. Many companies have gone to automated machines and robots to process and package food. But as Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports, it still takes thousands of workers with knives and very little automation to keep a modern beef plant up and running.
This story begins at the end, at least the end for the cow, which at this point doesn't even resemble a once living thing. It's been trimmed down to tenderloins, roasts, and steaks. Walking through a meat cutting line through JBS here in Greeley, Colorado, there are workers in white frocks and white hats using hooks and knives to trim up some of the meat and get rid of the fat.
Here's right at 850 people right out of this building alone.
That's the plant's manager, Bill Danley. He's on the floor, short for fabrication floor, where whole cattle carcasses become the neat and trim cuts of beef you get in restaurants and grocery stores. Hundreds of workers stand on raised platforms along conveyor belts, hanging carcasses stripped of skin inch along, strapped to a track above.
Like I said, that is a split carcass. That's a whole beef. And then we start the disassemble process out here on the fab floor.
Each person holds a knife in one hand, a sharpening steel to the side. And like a medieval warrior, every worker is besuited in what's really called chainmail, a protective mesh lining under blood-spattered white jackets.
You can kind of watch how they're boating this here. Very, very crucial they don't cut into that tenderloin.
The plant is a far cry from the butcher shops of yore, where a single person would need to know how to turn an entire animal into cuts of meat. Large beef companies like JBS, Cargill, and Tyson have turned each minute step of the process into a job. Danley lists some of the titles: a chuck boner, tender puller, back splitter, a knuckle dropper.
Hey, there's a lot of jobs out here that prep for the other person.
Each year, this one plant pays out more than $100 million in paychecks to its 3,000 employees. It's a huge chunk of the company's operating costs. And while robots have revolutionized manufacturing industries across the globe, the beef industry has stubbornly held on to its workers. In the U.S., meatpacking plants are actually expected to add jobs in the next decade. But why not robots?
You can't do the fine cutting that you see on the fab floor. That's probably one of the big challenges right now.
That's JBS Beef Division President Bill Rupp.
And I mean, some of that meat is, gosh, $6, $10, $12, $14 a pound. And so the key is being able to leave it on the meat and not on the bone. I mean, that's how our business works, so.
Rupp says the company's looked at robots that use vision technology to slice and dice. But the key to butchery is touch, not sight, he says. And robots just can't feel how deep a bone is or expertly remove an intact filet mignon.
This is when you get into that detailed, skilled cutting. Robots aren't there yet. Someday, I'm sure they will be.
Workers are really cheaper than machines.
Don Stull studied the cultures of meatpacking towns at the University of Kansas for 30 years.
Machines have to be maintained. They have to be taken good care of. And that's not really true of workers. As long as there is a steady supply, the workers are relatively inexpensive.
Inexpensive because you don't need a ton of skills to butcher cattle in big plants these days. Turnover in the industry is high because of the physical demands. And there's a stream of immigrants and refugees ready to put on the chainmail and pick up the knife. Still says workers tend to transfer jobs at the same plant just to avoid falling apart.
You know, after you do the same thing thousands of times a day, 6 days a week in the summertime when beef plants are running at higher capacity, you know, your body wears down.
Meatpacking jobs consistently rank among the most hazardous in the country. Increased automation could ease some of those injuries, Stull says. But until technology catches up, meatpacking companies will continue hiring low-skill workers to cut up our meat. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Coming up from Harvest, what does organic mean to you? We hear a bunch of different opinions. That's in about 15 minutes. From the slaughterhouse to the farmer's market, or maybe we should call this one not a market, but rather a farm stand. Inside Indiana University's Memorial Union, they've started selling local produce once a week to students, faculty, and staff. Maybe this is a sign of where the local food economy is headed. Our very own Annie Corrigan has this report.
It's Wednesday morning on the Indiana University campus. Walk inside the Indiana Memorial Union and you'll see fluorescent lights, flat-screen TVs on the walls, and a few tables of vegetables and baskets.
Today, we are running a small farmer's market.
Zachary Knudsen stands at a cash register. He's the director of purchasing for Sodexo at the IMU.
We have kale, we have fresh green beans, we have...
Amanda Abrams is ringing up customers. It hasn't been too busy today, but she's sure business will pick up once students come back to campus.
We have cantaloupe, watermelon, green peppers.
The variety is impressive, and it all looks to be in pristine condition. I ask Knudsen the question you'll hear over and over again at any farmer's market. Where did this food come from?
So what we've asked our vendor to do is basically collect produce within 150 mile radius of Indianapolis. That is what we consider, or that is our definition of local. And they put it onto a list for me, basically. And I select out 10, 12, maybe even sometimes 15 items. The food got here 2 days ago on a refrigerated truck from Indianapolis. As far as how it was procured from the farm, I actually do not know that far in the supply chain.
And there are no farmers here today to vouch for their products, so that's where the conversation stops. That's right, no farmers at the IMU Farmers Market. So should they even be calling this space a farmer's market at all?
I mean, I think maybe it's a farm stand.
Steve Holt is a food and nutrition writer. He recently penned an article for Civil Eats titled Five Ways America's Farmers Markets Have Evolved. You can picture a farm stand, table on the side of the road with produce on it. There's a jar in which customers drop their money, and the farmer likely isn't there. To talk about what a farmer's market is, Holt started with the government's definition.
The USDA says a farmer's market is defined as a multi-stall market at which farmer producers sell agricultural products directly to the general public at a central or fixed location, particularly fresh fruit and vegetables.
There are also social transactions that take place at farmers markets between customers and producers. In some ways, he says, those transactions are even more important than the financial ones.
You know, I also want to make room for a broader definition of farmers markets, you know, in sort of the 21st century that, you know, might include social media interaction and maybe an online marketplace. I think increasingly these virtual spaces are supplementing the physical market spaces and allowing producers to connect meaningfully with more customers than ever.
Local growers also have more buyers than ever, like distributors that connect them with institutions like Indiana University. This could explain why direct-to-consumer sales have stagnated in recent years, even as the number of farmers markets across the country has ballooned. Holt suggests this isn't a sign of decreased demand, but increased supply, as farmers diversify how and where they sell their food. To say it another way, farmers aren't putting all their eggs in the farmer's market basket.
You know, markets are tough on farmers. You've got to pack everything up. You have to guess roughly or exactly how much produce to bring. Sometimes you're driving hundreds of miles to the market, so there's gas involved. If you don't go yourself, you pay for someone to drive and to sit at the market in your place. You're constantly marketing your product while you're there. Giving out samples, engaging passersby, calling out what you're selling, you know, and that can be difficult sometimes for farmers who are used to spending long periods of time alone in the fields. And so, you know, I hear from producers a lot that markets can be a tough sell, you know, from a financial and economic perspective.
Customers, too, have many more ways to engage with local food. But traditional farmers markets are still important spaces for certain groups of people, particularly immigrants.
My local market here caters to a large number of Central American immigrants, and they're able to find some foods at the market here that they can't find anywhere else in the city because producers know there's a market here for that in my neighborhood in particular, and they are growing those foods. And people will line up before the market has even started, just so that they because those are the things that sell out first.
Veggies like chipilín and hierba mora, which Holt says are popular among his neighborhood Salvadoran immigrants.
$3. Okay.
There's nothing out of the ordinary for sale at the Indiana Memorial Union Farmers Market, or let's just decide to call it a farm stand. Abram says there is one unique thing at this farm stand that could draw customers.
You can't beat the prices because they're just pretty much set at wholesale.
60 cents for a bunch of kale, 75 cents for a spaghetti squash. She says the IMU isn't in this to make money. They just want to provide a service to students and staff.
There you go, Shannon.
You're welcome, Amanda.
Thank you, ma'am. Uh-huh.
And maybe cheap prices could tempt new customers to engage with their local food system. For Earth Eats, I'm Annie Corrigan.
Next week, Jennifer Mita Robinson will talk about the words we use to describe spaces where customers buy local food. Is it time to start policing the phrase farmer's market? We'll be talking about this on our Twitter feed over the next several days, too. Stop by and add your 2 cents. That's at Earth Eats. Coming up, from the breakfast table to the pint glass.
That's all what beer is making oatmeal and then adding some hopping yeast. That's it.
A little homebrewing 101 lesson with the Bloomington Hop Jockeys. That story in less than 10 minutes.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington.
Hey, welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Mark Chilla, filling in as your host. So while I'm sitting here in the hosting chair, Annie Corrigan, that lucky duck, is in the kitchen with Daniel Orr. They're working with some local watermelon to make a refreshing drink. First, the trick of peeling a watermelon.
And what I'm going to do is I cut off the top and the bottom, and that way it sits stable. And then I'm going to take the peel off of it. And you just kind of follow the line. You follow right along that melon rind, and you can use the melon rind for pickling. A lot of people don't know that, but back in the day when they didn't have a whole lot to eat during the war and between the wars, World War I, World War II, you know, people made do with what they had, and watermelon rinds were a favorite to have alongside cold cuts and smoked fresh local ham and that kind of thing. And what you do is take the rind, take the peel off of it, so you're just using the white part, and then pickle it with some sugar and spices and then you could store it, you could can it.
Yeah, so it's a sweet preparation.
Right, exactly. So now you have your nude watermelon. And what a lot of people don't know is that the seeds do grow in a circle. So if you cut that in half, you can see there's a nice center part that has no seeds. So go ahead and cut that out in a circle. And then you can just take your knife and get rid of all the little seeds. Okay, we're going to throw these nice chunks into the blender.
I have to say, this is part of why I don't really enjoy watermelon so much, because dealing with the seeds is so tedious.
Right, but you can see, if you know where the seeds are, it's not that difficult. And I think that the watermelons with seeds actually taste a lot better than the seedless varieties. And I know a lot of people love the simplicity and ease of the seedless varieties, but they just aren't quite as sweet. All right, so we've got these nice and seeded, and we're going to puree this. And if you want to, you could add a little bit of water to get the engine going. So we'll just put a little splash in here. And we're going to whiz it around. Easy as that. Now what we're going to do, just to make it a little more fun, is put some fresh herbs in it. So we're going to use some mint. Chiffonade, which means that we're going to cut it into thin little ribbons. Okay, and then I've got some frozen glasses. What we're going to do is put the mint leaves in first, so when we pour the melon puree over the top, it will mix in. And that's all there is to it.
Let's give it a taste, you and me, Chef. Cheers.
Cheers. Here's to Earth Eats.
Mmm. Yummy.
Isn't that fresh? Perfect cure for a hot day.
Or any day, really. See this bright pink drink on our website, eartheats.org. What does organic mean to you? Maybe it's about what you buy at the grocery store, or do you think it's a gimmick? Harvest Public Media's Abby Wendell recently went to the Illinois Organic Growers Association's Organic Fest. She learned that some people think it's new school, some people think it's old school, and some are happy to pay more to get it. Here's her audio postcard from Illinois.
My name's Marnie Ruckert. I'm the coordinator for the Illinois Organic Growers Association. Organic, to me, I guess at its core level, is taking care of the soil, first and foremost, but a general overall care for the land, care for the earth, the people, and the animals.
My name is Tori Zimmerman. I would define organic as without any use of pesticides.
I'm Jason Qualia from Chicago. We have a piece of land on the northwest side of Chicago that's just laying vacant that we're hoping to put in urban organic farming. You know, people in Chicago want to see organic. You know, it's a big selling point. And not only that, you know, we have so much pollution up there, you know, adding more chemicals to the mix, just, you know, I don't think people would be for that.
I'm Kurt Forty. I'm 62 years old, and I grew up, everybody was an organic farmer back then. And I remember back in about 1960, when the neighbor came over and the first time that we sprayed atrazine on the corn. Well, my dad thought it was a wonderful thing because it was so easy to control the weeds. So the major difference, the only real difference between a chemical farmer and an organic farmer is their choice of weed control.
Hi, my name is Dane Hunter. My dad and I farm about 1,200 acres. We raise primarily corn, soybeans, and wheat. We use traditional herbicides and pesticides and things to manage our crops. So a lot of people look at organic as just not using pesticides, which is kind of a misnomer. I view organic as being just a holistic management approach. My dad and a lot of conventional farmers view it as, I think, kind of a gimmick. A lot of organic fields compared to a lot of conventionally herbicides managed fields just have more weeds in them, which is kind of a faux pas for the agriculture community, especially a lot of older farmers, where your merit wasn't necessarily gauged by your bottom line or your profit margins as much as having weed-free pretty fields. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes chastising of organic fields. Not all. Sometimes they do meet even, you know, conventional farmer standards for clean, weed-free fields, but that's kind of the perception that a lot of conventional farmers have of organic fields.
I can see it. I used to be that way, too. If I'd see weeds in somebody's field, I'd say, oh, what's wrong with him? But it's just a change in mindset. You know, everything you do affects the land and your food. So keep it simple and don't add synthetic, you know, non-natural stuff. My name's Tom Yukas. I have 480 acres farmed organically the last 8 years up in northern Illinois.
Hi, I'm Colleen Yukas. I think it's a whole food movement, going to healthier food. I think I was like a lot of other people that had the mindset that if food was on sale at a chain grocery store, that was wonderful and that's what I was going to buy. And I think my husband had a good point when I didn't want to buy organic potatoes that were $2 a pound. He came to me and he said, look at this bag of chips. How much did you pay for this bag of chips? And I said, $3.58. And he said, well, how much per pound would that 8-ounce bag of chips be? So as my mindset changed, I'm really happy that he chose to start being an organic farmer, and I'm really proud of him.
Audio, video, and print stories from the world of agriculture at harvestpublicmedia.org. Coagulating proteins, activating enzymes, just some things you might overhear at a beer-making demonstration. It all sounds very technical, yes, but the process of brewing beer yourself is fairly easy. I'll take you now to a homebrewing 101 lesson with the Bloomington Hop Jockeys.
I'm getting prepared to mash the grain, so
Mike Kursilov is mixing up hot water and crushed grain in a cooler that he's redesigned himself. It's all part of a homebrewing demonstration. Right now, he's working on a special recipe in a beer-making process called all grain.
So not quite boiling, but it will hurt.
Okay, you ready? Here's your all-grain homebrewing 101 lesson. It's fairly simple. You start out with crushed grain.
So we're going to pour this grain in here. And this is 7 pounds of British two-row.
To that grain, you add warm water. As the water mixes with the grain, sugars are extracted. Those sugars will become the fuel for the brewing process once the yeast is added. But first, you have to filter out the grain, leaving the sugary, watery byproduct called the wort.
I don't want the grain. I just want the liquid that is more or less making like an oatmeal soup. That's all what beer is making oatmeal and then adding some hop and yeast. That's it.
And, of course, you need to let it sit, too, to ferment. More on the beer making in just a second. Kursilov is the events coordinator of the Bloomington Hop Jockeys, an organization of homebrewing enthusiasts that meets once a month at Upland Brewery's tasting room. They've been meeting since 2004. Jason Mundy has also been a member of the Hop Jockeys for even longer than Mike, going on 10 years now. He's seen interest in the club grow over the years.
That first night that I went, I think that there was like 8 people in there. You know, now I go to a meeting and there's like 30.
So who are these hop jockeys? Well, home brewers tend to be tinkerers and learners.
You know, it seems like half the people at the club, you know, are some type of engineering field. Then the other half of the club seems to be made up of grad students at IU.
The Hop Jockeys Club is all about promoting beer making in Southern Indiana. They do this by sharing recipes and by tasting each other's beers, and they also share the ways to create their equipment, all part of this tinkerer mentality.
I like hobbies. I'm one of those guys, there's a lot of us, we like being jack of all trades where you get really good at frisbee golf, or you get really good at chess, or you get really good at something, you're like, okay, now for the next thing. Those people who do that, I think every once in a while we find like those one or two we really like. They become more crafts, and beer just happened to be one of those things I really liked.
While the Hop Jockeys have been encouraging amateur beer making in the last 11 years, there's also been an increase in the amount of professional craft beer in Bloomington. And the Hop Jockeys can be held at least partially responsible for that. Take Steve Llewellyn, the brewmaster at Function Brewing, which opened in Bloomington in 2014.
Function Brewing, he was a club member from way back.
All right, let's go back to the beer.
So this is going to sit here for an hour.
At this demonstration, the hop jockeys are doing everything but the fermentation. Kursilov won't be able to enjoy his beer for a few weeks. Beer making for him is just a hobby, not anything professional. So that special recipe that he's using has a very personal connection to him.
It's a recipe called Poe's Boston Bitter, but it's to replicate a recipe apparently that was around during Edgar Allan Poe's time, and he was a big drinker. Did he drink it? I don't know. But my undergrad and my master's is in English literature. I used to be a high school English teacher, and so finding a literary connection is always great.
More stories about beer and wine and spirits on our website. Check them out at eartheats.org. We have a team at Earth Eats that I'm proud to be a part of. Aobon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, the reporters at Harvest Public Media, and of course, Annie Corrigan.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer.
I've had a blast today. Thanks for joining me. Annie Corrigan will be back in the chair next week. Bye for now. I'm Mark Chilla.